Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 8, Beginning of My Political Activity. By the end of November 1918, I was back in Munich. I went to the reserve battalion office of my regiment, which was in the hands of the new soldiers' councils. The whole administration was so disgusting to me that I decided to leave as quickly as possible. With a faithful friend of the campaign at my side, Ernst Schmidt, I traveled to Traunstein, a town in the southeast part of Bavaria, Germany, and remained there until the camp was broken up. In March of 1919, we went back to Munich. The situation there was shaky, which threatened to continue the revolution. Eisner's death only hastened the development, and it finally led to the dictatorship of the councils. Kurt Eisner, the Bavarian socialist politician, journalist, and organizer of the socialist revolution, died in February of 1919. He was killed by a lone assassin not associated with the Nazi movement. He previously led the Munich Revolution and became premier of Bavaria. Or, more accurately put, to a temporary Jewish domination, which was the original goal of those who created the revolution. At that time, plans bounced back and forth in my head. For days, I considered options and thought about what could possibly be done, but the result of every train of thought was the sober realization that no one knew me and I did not have the means to actually do anything. Later, I will explain the reason why I could not even make up my mind which of the existing political parties to join. During the new revolution of the councils, for the first time, I behaved in a way that the Central Council found annoying. The later result was that I was to be arrested early in the morning of April 27, 1919, but the three fellows who came for me did not have enough courage when facing the muzzle of my rifle to complete their task and ran off as quickly as they came. A few days later, after the liberation of Munich, I was ordered to appear before the Commission of Investigation to discuss the revolutionary events in the 2nd Infantry Regiment. This was my first, somewhat, purely political activity. Within a few weeks, I received orders to attend a course, or a series of lectures, which was being held for members of the military forces. Here, a soldier was supposed to receive a definite foundation for his thinking as a citizen. The only value in the performance to me was that it gave me a chance to meet like-minded comrades with whom I could discuss the real situation at hand. We were all firmly convinced that Germany could no longer be saved from the coming catastrophe, certainly not by the parties who committed the November crime, the surrender and formation of the Weimar Republic, the Center Party, and the so-called Democratic Party. Even if they had the best intentions in the world, the so-called privileged class nationalist organizations could never correct what had already been done. They lacked the full set of necessary fundamentals, and without them, such a task could not succeed. Time has shown that our view was correct. In our little circle, we discussed the formation of a new party. The basic ideas we had in mind were the same that were later realized in the German Workers' Party, the DAP, precursor to the Nazi Party. The name of the movement to be founded must help us reach the broad masses from the very beginning. Without the ability to reach the masses, the whole task would be senseless and unnecessary. We hit on the name Social Revolutionary Party, because the social views of the new organization actually constituted a revolution. But there was also a much deeper reason for the name. Attentive as I had always been to economic problems, my focus had been confined to the social problems. Only later were the bounds of my attention extended as I examined the Triple Alliance. The alliance was between Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy, which Hitler detested. This alliance was mostly the result of a poor assessment of the economic system, as well as a vagueness about the basis on which the German people could be sustained in the future. All these ideas rested on the opinion that money was only the product of labor, and finances could be corrected by adjusting issues that helped or hurt human activity. In fact, this unexpectedly revealed the true role of money, because it depended completely on the greatness, freedom, and power of the state and people. This dependency requires financial sectors to actively support the state and people. It is a matter of instinct and self-preservation for the improvement of its own development. The necessary dependence of finances upon the independent free state would compel financial sectors to work for this freedom, power, and strength of the nation. This made the duty of the state toward finances comparatively simple and clear. It only had to be certain that capital remained a servant of the state and did not become the master of the people. The expression of this attitude could then remain within two boundary lines: preservation of a healthy, independent national economy on one side, and the safeguarding of the wage earner's social rights on the other. Previously, I did not realize there was a difference between capital as the result of work and a capital derived from speculation investments, not until I received a push in the right direction. This push was by one of the various gentlemen who lectured in the previously mentioned course, Gottfried Feder, an economic theoretician who was later a key member and guided the Nazi Party. For the first time in my life, I heard a basic outline explaining the workings of international finance and loan capital. When I heard Feder's first lecture, the idea instantly flashed through my mind that I had now found my way to accomplish one of the key essentials needed in the foundation of a new party. In my mind, Feder's merit was demonstrated in his ruthless and vigorous method of describing the double character of the finances used in stock exchanges and loan transactions. He laid bare the fact that this capital is always dependent on the payment of interest. His explanations of all the basic questions were so sound that from the start, his critics did not dispute the theoretical correctness of the idea, but they doubted the possibility that it could be carried out. What others considered a weakness in Feder's arguments, I thought was the strong point. The task of the plan's creator is not to lay out the details needed to fulfill the plan, but to explain the plan. He should be concerned less with the method and more with the goal. The essential truth behind an idea is the deciding factor, not the difficulty in carrying it out. The moment the plan's creator attempts to consider so-called convenience and reality, instead of absolute truth, his work will no longer be a star-seeking humanity and will become nothing more than an everyday procedure. The program maker of a movement must determine its goal. The politician must attempt to reach it. Accordingly, the thinking of the plan's creator is determined by eternal truth, and the action of the politician is determined by the practical reality of the movement. The greatness of one man lies in the truth behind the theory of his idea, and in his proper approach to the given facts. The greatness of the other lies in his practical use of them. The goal set up by the plan's creator must serve as a guiding light to others. The test of a politician's importance is the success of the plans and actions as they become a reality, even though the final intention of the plan's creator can never be realized. Human thought can indeed grasp truths and set up goals as clear as crystal, but their complete fulfillment will be prevented by the universal imperfection and inadequacy of man. True. The truer the theory and the more tremendous the idea, the more impossible it is to achieve as long as it depends on human beings. For that reason, the importance of the plan's creator cannot be measured by the achievement of his goals, but by their rightness and the influence they have on the development of humanity. If this were not true, the founders of religion could not be considered to be among the greatest men on earth, since the fulfillment of their moral goals are not even close to being achieved. Even that, which is called the religion of love, is only a shadow of the will of its righteous creator, but its importance is in the attempt to convey ethics and morals to the general development of human culture. This fundamental difference between the tasks of the political philosopher or plan's creator and the politician is also the reason why the two are almost never the same person. It is particularly true of the so-called successful, or more accurately, the uninformed or unimportant politician, whose actions are limited to the art of the possible, as Bismarck defined politics. The more such a politician avoids great ideas and sticks to that which he can easily accomplish, the easier his job becomes, the more obvious his small victories, and always the quicker his successes will be. These successes have an earthly and brief life, and often do not live longer than the author. The work of this sort of politician is of no importance to future generations, since its present success depends solely on avoiding crucial problems and ideas. The solution to larger problems are actually valuable for later generations, as well as the current one. The accomplishment of goals which will have value and meaning for distant generations is usually unrewarding for their champions today and are rarely accepted or understood by the great masses. The masses understand reductions in beer and milk prices better than deep plans for a distant time where the benefits will only be seen by their future generations. A close relative of stupidity is vanity, and vanity is the reason the great majority of politicians will distance themselves from any difficult plans for the future. They want to avoid losing the momentary favor of the crowd. The success and importance of such a politician then lies entirely in the present, and their actions have no meaning for the future. This doesn't bother the small-minded. They are satisfied with immediate results. The political philosopher is a different matter. His importance almost always lies totally in the future. Since he is frequently what we call a dreamer. If the art of the politician is considered the art of doing the possible, then the political philosopher is one whom it is said pleases the gods only when he demands the impossible. He will almost always have to give up fame in the present, but in its place, if his ideas are immortal, he receives glory from future generations. Once in a very long time, a politician and political philosopher may be one and the same, but the more intimate this fusion, the greater the resistance will grow to the politician's efforts. Trump. He is no longer working for necessities obvious to the average person, but for goals only a few can understand. His life is torn between love and hate. The protests of those presently around him who do not understand the man will battle against his struggle to accomplish something important for posterity. The greater the future will be for a man's work, the less the present can grasp it, the harder the battle will be, and the rarer success will be found. If success does smile on one man in centuries, a glimmer of the coming glory may possibly surround him in old age. Even so, these great men are just the marathon runners of history. The glory of the present only rests upon the brow of the dying hero. We must count these men as the great workers of the world. Those are the men who are not understood by the present, but who are nevertheless ready to fight to the end for their ideas and ideals. They are the ones who will someday be closest to the people's hearts. Each of these individuals felt it was his duty to repay the wrongs which great men have suffered at the hands of their contemporaries. Their lives and their work are then studied with touching and grateful admiration. In dark days of distress, such men have the power to heal broken hearts and elevate the people from despair. To this group belong only the genuinely great statesmen, but all the great reformers as well. Besides Frederick the Great, Frederick II from the Hohenzollern dynasty, who united much of the Prussian dynasty, we have such men as Martin Luther, the monk and Protestant church reformer, and Richard Wagner, the famous anti-Semitic German composer. When I heard Gottfried Feder's first lecture on breaking the slavery of interest, I immediately knew that this was a theoretical truth which was of huge importance for the future of the German people. The separation of finance capital from the national economy made it possible to oppose the internationalization of the German economy without threatening national self-preservation. I saw Germany's development much too clearly not to have known that the hardest struggle would have to be fought against international capital and not against hostile people. In Vader's lecture, I heard a mighty rallying call, or cry, for this coming struggle. Subsequent developments showed how right our feeling was. Today, we are no longer laughed at by our deceptive, privileged class, sly boots politicians. Today, if they are not deliberate liars, even they see that international finance capital not only took the lead in nurturing the war, but especially after the struggle has ended, it is doing, it is doing everything possible to make the peace into hell. The struggle against international finance and loan capital interests has become the most important point in the program of the German nation's economic independence and freedom. For those practical people who may object, I offer these answers. All apprehensions about the economic consequences that would follow the abolition of the slavery that results from interest-based financing capital are not valid because, in the first place, the economic principles that we have previously followed already proved to be quite disastrous to the interests of the German people. The comments by the authors of those plans on questions of their self-preservation strongly remind us of the past verdicts passed out by similar experts, such as the Bavarian Medical Faculty, regarding the question of introducing the railroad. We now know that none of this exalted body's fears have happened since riders of the new steam horse did not become dizzy, spectators watching the train pass were not made ill, and the board fences intended to hide the new inventions are gone. All that is left are invisible blinders on the so-called experts, and those will always be there. In the second place, we should remember that any idea becomes dangerous if it presumes to be an end in itself, but in reality, it is just a means to an end. For me and all true National Socialists, there is only one doctrine, Volk and Fatherland. We must fight to assure the existence and the growth of our race and our nation. We must feed our children and keep our blood pure. We must fight for the freedom and independence of the fatherland so that our nation may grow and fulfill the mission given to it by the creator of this universe. Every ideal and every idea, every teaching and all knowledge must serve this purpose. It is from this perspective that we must judge everything and use it or discard it according to its suitability for our purpose. In this way, a theory can never harden into a deadly doctrine, since it must all serve the common good. The insight of Gottfried Feder led me to deep study in a field where I previously had little knowledge. I resumed the process of learning and came to realize for the first time the purpose behind the life work of the Jew Karl Marx. Now, I really began to understand his currency, the capital he used, as well as the struggle of social democracy against the national economy, a struggle that was meant only to lay the groundwork for the rule of the true international finance by interest-based money. In another respect, these courses had a great effect upon my later life. One day during the course, I asked for the floor in a discussion after one of the men attending the course felt compelled to break a lance for the Jews and defended them at great length. This aggravated me so much that I had to reply. The overwhelming majority of those present were on my side. The result was that a few days later, I was assigned to a Munich regiment as an education officer. The discipline of the troops at that time was still fairly weak. They suffered from the after-effects of the Soldiers' Council. The introduction of military discipline and subordination in place of voluntary obedience, a term for the filth under Kurt Eisner, who led the Marxist revolution in Bavaria and was premier until 1919, had to be implemented very slowly and cautiously. The troops themselves had to learn to feel and think as nationalists and be patriotic. My new focus was pointed in those two directions. I happily began my task. Suddenly, I had an opportunity to speak before large audiences. What I had always felt and assumed to be true was now being proven. I could speak. My voice had improved enough so that people could always understand me, at least in the small squad room. No task could have made me any happier. Now, before being discharged, I could do a useful service for the institution which had been so close to my heart, the Army. I can say my talks were a success. During the course of my lectures, I led hundreds, probably thousands, of my comrades back to their folk and fatherland. I nationalized the troops and was able to help strengthen the general discipline. In the process, I became acquainted with a number of comrades who believed as I did and later formed the center of the new movement.